I hear there's rumors on the internets.
Greetings from Hanoi, Bratislava, and Kansas City. My name is Henrik.
And you're listening to the Check Your Facts podcast. So, Henrik, a lot has happened recently, right?
It sure has, David. Pretty exciting stuff, actually.
Exactly. For starters, you are in Hanoi, the capital of Vietnam, which means that this episode spans across three zones, and I guess three different... and that's a record for us. So what about your old jet lag?
Yeah, I've been a lot less jet lagged than I expected, but I'm getting a little bit sleepy now. It's already 10 p.m. over here, so if I say crazy stuff, I will just blame the jet lag.
It's okay, Henrik. Anyway, we recently launched a new feature on micro podcast blogging app. We call it Fact of the Day. For all of you listeners who haven't seen it, you know, we can tell it's a feature where we publish facts on carefully selected topics. We try to do it daily, but sometimes...
Yeah, a few times a week.
Not every day. So far, we've published a few different facts, and we actually plan to track like daily or a few weekly.
Yeah, and we also Yeah, exactly. And we also created a Medium series to accompany this feature. And in the Medium series, we publish short summaries of every fact with useful links. So if you have a Medium account, you should subscribe to updates to the series and also give us a few claps if you like it.
Yeah, definitely do so. You should also favorite our station on Anchor. So you can like, it's like not a favorite, it's more like a subscribe. And then you can hear the full stories.
And if you don't have the Anchor app, we urge you to download the app because we both love it, don't we, David?
Sure do, Henry. And there's a lot of high quality like audio content in the app. And this is actually not an advertisement. We just so much love the whole platform.
Exactly.
And it actually looks great.
Yeah, it's a lot more visual now than it was before. So just like the Medium series, which is also a pretty new format, it's a very modern approach to visual storytelling.
Yes, and speaking about storytelling, this is the right cue to introduce. Yes, so...
With that being said, let's welcome our next guest on the podcast, Rachel Salon. Journalist and visual storyteller.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So Rachel, how are you doing?
Good. I am in Kansas City visiting right now, but I normally live in Miami, and I'm happy to be here.
Nice.
How's the weather in Miami? I wonder, is it like hot all the time?
It is, and I actually read that it's very, very today there, and it's one of my favorite things about Miami. It is always warm.
How about Kansas City? Nice.
It's getting there. It's trying to get into spring. It's still a little chilly, but it's working on it.
Sounds terrific.
So Henrik, I guess we should tell the story how we got to new digital Slack community, which we are part of. I think it was you who posted the link to her newsletter.
Yes.
And that was the how I subscribed to it, and I love it.
Yeah.
And
we should perhaps we should perhaps say the name of the newsletter. It's Best in Visual Storytelling.
And yeah, it's is it weekly, Rachel? I don't remember now, or is it like more often?
Yeah, it's weekly-ish. I curate the newsletter, which has the best in visual storytelling. It's things that catch my eye in photography, interactive, graphics, and basically anything interesting in visuals. And I send it about once a week. It kind of depends on when I come across things that I want to include.
Okay, so
nice.
Why did you decide to create this newsletter?
I started doing it actually as an internal product at the last place I worked at, which was Fusion. And I wanted to inspire the editors and show them what the possibilities were within visual storytelling. So I started a newsletter where they could see examples, and I was hoping that it would strike inspiration when they had stories that they could work with the team that I ran, which was the interactive team. And I left Fusion in November when I was laid off. I decided to open it up into a public newsletter and invite people from the journalism community as well.
So what did you do when you worked at this news outlet?
I was the interactive editor, and so I ran a team of designers and developers where we basically did all of the visual projects, whether that was like long form storytelling, graphics, data analysis. We did a lot of investigative projects, collaborating with the investigative team. We were basically the go-to team for anything that we wanted to be special or experimental.
Wow, and have you also worked on the release of the Panama Papers reporting?
I didn't personally work on that, but members of my team before I got there were working on Panama Papers, yes.
Nice.
Very nice. So for how long have you worked with visual storytelling in journalism, in digital journalism?
I've been working in visual storytelling my entire career. I started out as a print designer, actually, for a newspaper. And then I learned to code and I started to get into digital design, which led me to do things like interactive journalism and graphics and fun visual storytelling. And from there, I've worked as a front-end designer, a front-end developer, and then I've been managing teams that do that kind of work.
So what kind of coding do you do? Is it like JavaScript, CSS and stuff, markup, or?
Yeah, my skills are in front-end, HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, but there have been people that on the teams that I've run that are also back-end developers and do a lot of database work and much more advanced stuff than the stuff I actually know how to do.
Can I have just one question? You said you were part of the you left Fusion. On your Twitter stream, I read you have the tweet pinned that you were part of the Fusion layoffs and you were looking for work. And I see a lot of it got a lot of retweets and favorites and also replies. So was this a way to get a new job for you? Did it work?
It hasn't worked yet, but I'm hoping that it will. I was part of the Fusion layoffs. They did a ton of layoffs. And so I've been applying and interviewing at places ever since. But I do think that Twitter is a really effective way to get your name out there and share your portfolio. I know that a lot of my colleagues who were also laid off, we have been able to treat each other and to raise awareness of different people and kind of use our Twitter networks to help give everyone a boost.
So
go on, Henrik.
No, I was just thinking about the newsletter. Do you have you added it to your resume?
I have the newsletter on site, which is rachelshallum.com. I don't think I have it on my printed out resume, but I do have the link to my newsletter on my digital resume.
How many subscribers do you have? You don't have to answer if you don't want to, but
I have almost 500.
That's good. Wow. That's a lot more than we have.
It's maybe two zeros more.
So it's a pretty low number as far as newsletters go, but it's for a very niche audience. and I've gotten a lot of positive feedback on it. People write, reply to tell me that they enjoy it, or people have started to send me projects that they want me to consider putting in there. So I'm really happy with the engagement that it's gotten.
No, I mean, you don't really have to have like a 1,000 or 10,000 audience if you have like a small and really engaged, like niche audience. At least that's like my opinion.
Yeah, exactly. And one thing I've been wondering about is actually, it's two things, but we can start with the first one. And that's in this newsletter, you summarize the best in storytelling, the best visual storytelling features you've seen during the week or like recently. But since you started this newsletter, which are, you know, the top two or top three visual storytelling pieces you've seen?
Ooh. I don't know if I could narrow it down. There are so many, and I also find somewhat hard to compare them to each other.
But if let me rephrase if we say like this, what makes a really good visual storytelling piece?
So something that I'm always looking for in visual storytelling is that the visuals add to the story. They make you understand the story better, or they make the story more engaging. I'm not really interested in something that just makes it prettier or that makes things flash or are fancy. I want something that helps me understand the story, and those kinds of things are what I like to highlight in my newsletter. Another thing that I try really hard to do is to highlight visual storytelling that comes from places other than major news outlets such as the New York Times or the Washington Post. Of course, I almost always have at least one item from the big places just because they're doing such fantastic work. But I know that there's also good work coming from smaller news outlets like the Dallas Morning News. I've included local places like the Miami Herald. And I like to make sure that I'm highlighting those outlets to give them a boost in audience as well.
I read your last, which came out, was it yesterday or the day before?
Yesterday, yes.
Yesterday, right? And what got me a little bit interesting was you included also the piece by the LA Times about the lying president, that's the way it was called, and it struck me like, well, this, there's almost like non-visual there, but you still get that like black and white like visual storytelling because of the how they like managed to do it. So that was quite amazing as well, that you included such a work.
Yeah, what I liked about that is you could tell that they took the time to think about the presentation, and they wanted it to other opinion articles, but they didn't go over the top. So I thought it hit that balance really well. It definitely told me that they spent more time on it and that they were proud of it and they wanted you to see it as special.
And also, there was the piece by the New York Times about Uber. We will all include all the links. You can like check them out in the description of the episode, and like be sure to subscribe. We will also add the link to like Rachel's newsletter, so you can subscribe to it. But so again, the New York Times piece about Uber, how they are like making like incentives for the drivers to like go and drive. And there was like a lot. It was like for me, it looked really like visualizationally a lot of like IT work there, like developers, right? Am I right, or was it like just? It wasn't like only like so you know the Uber piece. right?
Yeah, so that one would have been a combination of development and animation and illustration. I think that's a good example of people with different skill sets coming together to create a really good project. And that one I included because the graphics autoplay, they didn't require you to touch a lot of buttons, which I think is going to be interesting as we move forward. There was an article not that long ago that was calling for the death of interactive graphics, that they took too long and people weren't engaging with them as much as the creators thought that they were. So I'm interested to see if this autoplay type of graphic is going to become the new hit thing.
And also there was an article, and I'm not sure if it was the same, but I heard some voices from New York Times that they're like making they made some changes to the interactive team so that they do not produce that many interactive pieces, but more like they will produce less and which are like better, like thought about, like as you said, so it will move if you do not touch it.
So like quality do you instead see of this, quantity.
Do you see this like something happening in any other news organizations, or is like New York Times?
Yeah, I think for a while a lot of news organizations just wanted to have these teams so they could put out projects that looked really nice. So that they felt like they were competing on the same level as all the other news organizations. And I think now we're seeing more thought put behind the interactives, and we're choosing to do projects that make sense, you know, that they really add to the storytelling and that they're not just there to be flashy, like I was saying earlier. And so I do think that we are hitting a quality over quantity, and that comes from years of looking at reader engagement data as well. We're starting to have a better idea of what people want and what they don't want. And I'm glad that teams are starting to really look at that and implement those findings into their work.
Also, talking about interactive teams and also the fact that you are yourself programming, but you're a journalist who can program. And lots of experts actually say that it will be vital for journalists to be able to create databases and analyze data and even do some programming, some coding. What do you think about that? Do you think it's vital for digital journalists to be able to do at least simple programming?
I don't think that all journalists need to know how to code. The advice that I give to college students is to have an understanding of the different departments in a news organization enough to be able to communicate with them effectively so that you can collaborate. So you should know just enough about coding and just enough about, let's say, video editing or the different parts of the news organization that you might not know how to do. You should know them enough to be able to collaborate with them. I think that coding is an excellent way to do journalism. There's just so much opportunity there for data analysis and data graphics, and I think it's a really exciting part of journalism to be in, but I don't think that it's the only way to do journalism, obviously. And so as long as you can collaborate with them, I think you're good to go.
So Rachel, well, as we see it in Europe, because a lot of this interactive work is mainly done in the US, actually. In the US, I do not see that many news organizations like competing who will do better graphics or interactives. Can you like, do you also look at the like the whole world, or is it like mainly US media?
I'm looking at mainly US media, but we do see a good amount of work coming out of The Guardian, both the traditional Guardian and The Guardian US. that's probably where I'm seeing the most work internationally. I could do a better job of knowing more international outlets so I can keep my eyes peeled for it.
What about the news agencies like Reuters and AP and stuff?
AP does have an interactive team on Twitter. Some of their work, it has their work, I think, especially in interactives, have gotten a lot better over the last couple of years. So that is interesting to me. But I would be curious at what audience their interactive work is getting, since most of their stories are, you know, picked up and put on other websites. It is interesting that they have an interactive team.
I know about the Czech agency, actually, the Czech news agency, which also has an interactive team, but they do like, let's say there will be like ice hockey, the championship of ice hockey. And so they do these like interactive widgets you can embed to your site, and they, you can like buy that from them. So maybe it is also this kind of work that the AP interactive team does. What do you think?
I'm not sure. I can't speak on that definitively, but I haven't seen it embedded on a website, but maybe I'm just missing it or unaware that it is there. I will say that we are seeing a rise in services that do things like that, because a lot of news organization websites are still shockingly terrible at incorporating code into them. So the easiest way to get, you know, something into one of the main CMSs is through a basic embed.
Okay, and where do you see? I mean, okay, so let's say I know that quite a few people from like Eastern Europe or Middle Europe are listening to this podcast, and they maybe have not done like something interactive themselves. So what would you suggest? Would you suggest to go out there and like look for some like open source alternatives, or like try to code themselves something small, or like how would you guide them if you ever had the chance?
Do you think that the external companies creating software is getting so advanced that you don't really need an interactive team to actually do the programming parts, sort of?
I don't think that we're there yet. There's still a lot of value in having the interactive team and being able to collaborate and build exactly what you're looking for. There are a lot of cases where I'll have an idea, and, you know, let's say a chart maker won't be able to do it exactly as I wish I could do it. The third-party tools are great resources to start doing this kind of work and to introduce it to your newsroom and be able to do it with not a ton of resources if you don't have the money to hire a full team. But being able to code from being able to code exactly what you want still has a lot of a value for journalists. When people are starting out, I would recommend that they do take a look at open source work. There's a lot of news organizations have put out their work there so that you can replicate it. You know, something like NPR got a ton of press for their live annotation tool when they were annotating Trump's speeches, and that is open source on GitHub. And so is that anything you want to do has probably been done before, or at least can be a good barrier or a good starting place for you. So that I do recommend open source.
Yeah, there's a lot of really cool projects on GitHub. So definitely.
There's actually, I don't know who's done it, some kind of open source initiative, but they put together a list of people and interactive teams across the media organization across the world. I have the link. I'll definitely include it in the description of the podcast. So that's interesting, because there's a long list of people and teams you can follow either on Twitter or on GitHub. And for example, that's the way, like, NPR also did. Rachel, do you remember they also really open source, they open source a bunch of things, but they also open source DALE 2 for like visual stories, you know, the ones that you click and like there's a piece of text and then the picture.
Yeah, I've been calling those type of stories step-by-step graphics where you read and then they're almost like slides that you go through. NPR had a ton of success with those, and I think they're really great ways to tell stories. I am always including those in my newsletter.
Also, I think New York Times is using that kind of storytelling, but a little bit different. I think they have their own tool, but I'm not sure about this.
The New York Times has been doing some fun stuff that is similar, but instead it's more vertical scrolling. You get new information as you scroll, where NPR's tool is more horizontal slide-like. Both of them are really interesting ways to tell stories.
Yeah, and we mentioned Medium and the new Medium series feature in the beginning of the episode. And the thing that I'm actually quite, well, I wouldn't say impressed, because I'm not impressed with the Medium series. I think it's a nice format, but personally, I like Stellar a lot more. The app Stellar, which Medium series basically is like a copycat of that. But anyway, the interesting part of Medium series is the fact that you can pick up on a story and continue to add content to a story instead of the way we are used to, like back in the good old print days when we wrote a reportage or something, you know, a long read, and then it was printed in the paper, and if you needed to add content afterwards, you had to write a follow-up. But now you can create a Medium series, and then you can just pick up where you left off. Do you think that this kind of continuous storytelling will become a thing in the media companies as well?
I'm not very familiar with Medium stories, but I will say that one of the big opportunities within interactive storytelling is providing context. And it can provide context that goes beyond or just the latest breaking news, but really put things into perspective on what this means and where it plays within the story. A lot of the storylines that we cover are super long, and you know, if people don't feel like they have an adequate backstory to understand what's going on, they're more likely to just tune out and not follow that story at all. We see that a lot with like international conflict. If people don't feel like they have enough of a basis, it's just a story that they're not going to engage with, even if they're kind of interested. So I do like that news organizations are experimenting with different ways of adding that context and telling a story in more of a long form way. NPR is doing some work with that. Tyler Fisher just published an article for Source called Subverting the Story Model, where he talks a lot about how we need to go beyond just story after story and show people more of the context and the perspective. So I can send you the link to that, and I would recommend reading that as well.
And now,
that link was actually in my last newsletter.
Oh, it was, yes.
That's nice.
I saved it.
We'll definitely add it to in the description of the episode. I was just wondering, because now you've given us quite a few examples of very good visual storytelling, and you said earlier that there was, you know, still some media outlets who did visual stuff only, you know, that looked good but didn't add anything to the story. Do you have some examples of bad visual storytelling?
Well, I'm not going to call anyone out on the podcast.
Yeah.
I would say that I mostly see them coming from smaller news organizations. And in those cases, I am just excited that they are trying something. I think trying and failing is way better than not doing it at all. And I wouldn't necessarily even call them failures, you know, but kind of putting something out there and seeing how it goes is really the only way to start doing something. But the things that cause me to take a look and maybe say that it's not as good as some of the other work I've done is when I don't understand the point of it, you know, that when I think, oh, that could have just been a text story, or what is the graphic really adding there? Or yeah. if it brings up more questions than answers, that is that's normally where I have some hesitations.
So now I'm gonna ask the two of you if you know what the point is with the New York Times graphical feature that they released some I think it was a month ago or something, where they had these charts which sort of, you know, ended before the real end, and then you could draw yourself the end of the chart.
You mean the charts?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So you guessed how the chart would end, and then you could see how far off you were. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, so that feature, I believe, was first done by 538. They have been doing it for, I would say, over a year now. I'm not exactly sure when the first one came out. It's a great way to test people's assumptions. And it works really well with things that people have strong feelings about but are actually number-based. So let's say things like welfare or healthcare numbers, things that you think you know but aren't, you know, but maybe your assumptions aren't really backed up by the actual statistics. And so I have seen the New York Times do it too. And so they're fun ways to kind of see, to really test your personal theories and then find out what the true facts are.
What do you think, David?
I didn't know that 538 was the first one. I actually thought the New York Times was.
Yeah, me too.
it's funny. They should do a better marketing, I think. No, I still follow 538 and I love what they are doing, but this was quite a surprise to me to hear this from you, Rachel.
Yeah, 538 has done some really excellent visual work, and they've really found their identity within the last year or so. I really love when I look at a graphic online and I can immediately tell who it's by, just having that strong branding. I get that from 538, and they also get that from the Marshall Project as well.
Oh yeah, they're really doing great stuff if they publish something. But I mean, they do not publish like often, right? So they publish like once in a while when they have like a big story. Or is it like, do they publish more often?
I think they publish incremental stories daily, but they do drop some really awesome big projects from time to time. You're right there.
And actually, when talking about interactive graphics, so there is this thing. So I'm sure you follow Quartz, and the thing that they're doing, like they came up with the chart builder. Now they have the Atlas, .com, which is like an overview of all their charts. And a few years back, everyone wanted to like embed interactive charts to their websites. Like news organizations, ours as well, and it was, I think, or Vox, I think, I'm not sure now, but they started doing like pictures instead of like interactive graphics, because I think the reason was because for like mobile views. So what's your take on this? Charts, should we do like interactives, or is better to do like really simple charts, like bar charts, or would you go like with a picture rather?
I think it depends on what you're doing and what your staff has. Pictures aren't great for it kind of, hold on, let me start over. It depends on what your goal is and what your staff is. Pictures can totally work depending on what you're doing, but it depends on how they resize for mobile. I have seen some photos because they resize proportionally, and then the text is a little hard to read on mobile. But and interactive graphics can solve that problem depending on your code that you're using. So I would say they both have pros and cons, and doing it is better than not doing it at all.
Okay. I actually get that.
Sounds reasonable.
I was just a little bit surprised because, yes, it totally does. I was just curious. Wanted another opinion. I actually like the way that they started doing the pictures because it always kind of always worked for my smartphone. Because, for example, if you embed a simple Google chart, it's not really responsive. I'm not sure.
No, Google charts are not responsive at all, which always shocked me when I tried to use them. But
right,
it is shocking.
I do think that people are going back to photos because they're seeing that it's time to have their developers working on things that are more complex and add more than just doing basic charts. And I do think that that's like an efficient use of time.
Yes, I totally agree with that. And Henrik, do you have a question? Because I have another kind of question not related to this topic we just talked about.
Yeah, I actually do. I have a question about... sorry?
Go on.
No.
No, go on.
I'm a little bit uncertain about the exact word, the term, but I think it's called cinematography, or like cinemagraphic. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like a combination of a standard photo and a video. So part of the photo is actually moving.
Yeah, those were really big for a while. I haven't seen them in a little bit, but they're basically where you maybe have a woman sitting at a table, yeah, and the only thing that moves is her eyes blink, or
exactly,
she moves her coffee mug, you know, an inch and back.
Yeah.
So it's kind of in between a GIF and a photo.
Yeah.
And I think when they're done well, they can be very visually engaging. But I actually haven't seen a lot of those recently, now that you bring it up.
Yeah, because I've noticed that they're actually coming back, at least when it comes to marketing. It's becoming quite popular among brands for marketing. So I was just wondering, because often when those kind of visual stuff become popular in the marketing sectors, it sometimes becomes popular in journalism as well. So I was thinking perhaps it will make a glorious comeback in digital journalism.
I think it makes sense in marketing because it is something that that stops you and really catches your eye. So that makes sense to me. I don't see a huge opportunity there for journalism because it just doesn't add a ton to the story other than being a visually engaging tool. So I'm not sure if they're going to make like a huge, but I do think that journalism could do a better job of looking at other industries and what they're doing digitally and visually, yeah, and kind of taking ideas from other industries instead of just continuing from each other. You yeah. know, there's a big habit, a smaller news organization looking at what the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal are doing and then trying to mimic those, when we should really be getting inspiration from and advertising and marketing and a bunch of other industries as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. David, I actually think it's I think you'll have to ask the last question, if you're up for it. We're getting to that point again.
Actually, okay, so I have like two last questions.
Two last questions. No problems. Go ahead. Shoot.
I'm sorry, I always do this. So, like, number one, regarding, I talked about the mobile. So, I think it was the New York Times. I'm guessing others as well. But they try, in the last couple of, like, months or last couple of, like, 2-3 years, they try to do interactive graphics with, or, like, you know, visual storytellings that were, like, that also worked on really well, or were specifically designed for smartphones. I'm not sure if you remember, but there was like, it was maybe 1 year ago, they dissected this song by Justin Bieber. It was like for mobile, so not in landscape view, but like I'm not sure. Do you know what I'm talking about or not really?
What was your question?
Yeah, that was super fun. So there's a difference in how you can approach mobile. There is mobile friendly, which means it works on mobile, and then there's mobile native, which means it was designed from mobile, and then it also happens to work on desktop. And so when you're doing mobile native, you're thinking about gestures that people are already using on their phone, like swiping, tapping, things that you don't do on your desktop, obviously. And as audiences are going more and more mobile, and as we're having the analytics to back that up, for instance, Quartz put out a new project today called Index, where they look at different statistics on the global economy. And they went with the mobile native approach for this new version of Index. And so they're using a lot of the things that we're used to using on their phone. And when they sent it to me, they said that their audience were on mobile. And so it didn't make sense to start on desktop and work backwards. It made sense to start on mobile. And mobiles are seeing similar statistics where they're at 50% or even over 50% on mobile. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, that's actually great stats.
Yeah, you know,
and
mobile should always be first. Always.
Well, yes. Actually, it depends on, for example, our news outlet is still has the majority of the visitors coming in from desktops. So, for example, if I went mobile first.
Mm.
I'm not sure if it always worked.
I would say that it would, because if you go mobile first, you will have to prioritize mobile and then scaling up, which is a lot easier than prioritizing desktop and then scaling down. That's a lot harder, technically.
Yes, I agree. Although our website is like really built. Our website was really built like without anyone thinking about mobile, so like that's something we are waiting for. To do a redesign. And so sorry, Rachel. And the last question is like regarding the Medium series. Also, we see like the Snapchat stories, Facebook and Instagram stories. So. Do you see that these platforms are somehow like encouraging the visual storytelling in people? What do you think? Because I'm like really curious to get someone else's perspective on this.
I think that people have always been really interested in visual storytelling when it makes sense, you know, when it's a moment that you can only get on video or a moment that you really need a photograph for. And so having it on our phones in the form of like Snapchat and Instagram stories really gives us a look into like other people's day, and it makes us feel more connected with them. And so I do think that we'll be inspired by that. And I hope that they do is that they take that platform and they use it in a smart way to tell stories. And it's not just like, hey, all the kids are on Snapchat and we need to be on Snapchat too, but a more intelligent and thoughtful approach at okay, if we know the audience is on Snapchat, how can we use the platform in a way that they're going to want to connect with us there? Because sometimes I think we enter in a new social media platform or just a new platform in general, and when we don't really know what we're doing, it's super obvious. And one of the big things that we can do with digital brands is tell people that, hey, we know how to use the internet. We know how to use these cool platforms that you're already on. And if you spend time with us, it's going to be worth it. It's going to work. You're going to learn something. It's going to be entertaining for you. And so that's why visual storytelling is so important to get right, because when you get it wrong, it's a really big hit to your brand.
Wow. That's actually really clever.
Yeah, really clever. Great, great last statement. So.
And sorry, just one more last question. Like, are you a Snapchat person or Instagram
the last question?
I am 100% Snapchat. I have yet to post an Instagram story. I don't understand why we're getting more of them. We have Snapchat already. Like, there are so many internet problems to solve. Go find a new one. We don't need any more of them.
Yes. So,
awesome.
I'm not on Snapchat, and I hate Instagram stories. But
man.
Yeah, I'm getting old.
Yeah. Well, you should do something with that. You should get some lessons on how to Snapchat from Rachel.
But you know, I have Stellar. That's pretty alternative. So.
Okay, but that's really a niche thing.
Yeah, I know. Rachel, it's been really great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. And you know.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. You were so clever.
Absolutely.
You know, I feel like this was really educational. So thanks for that.
We usually end our episodes by urging our listeners to check out our website, checkyourfacts.eu, and also to subscribe to our newsletter. But now we should also urge all of our listeners to subscribe to the Best in Visual Storytelling newsletter, because it's a very, very good newsletter.
Thank you so much. I would love to have you.
Yeah.
Cool. And also, don't forget to check out Rachel's website, her Twitter. She's really active on Twitter, so that's great. Yeah. And her Snapchat. Are you open for people following you on Snapchat, Rachel?
Yes, my Snapchat is open.
And what's your?
Be kind.
Be kind, exactly. Always be kind. That's our motto, sort of.
Okay, so also follow Rachel on Snapchat, and with that said, thanks for listening to us. And,
that's it for
bye
today.
Bye, Rachel.
Yeah.
Bye, guys.
See you on Snapchat or or someplace else.